Alpha.fm, Leading Edge Talk Radio. I'm Lisa Osborne. We're looking at sex addiction today as New York's former governor, Eliot Spitzer, is reportedly being treated for a sexual addiction, seeking help for that. I'm joined today by a recovering sex addict who's a woman. Sue William Silverman is the author of Lovesick, One Woman's Journey Through Sexual Addiction. Her memoir is becoming a Lifetime movie in April, so watch for that through your cable listings. Sue also teaches in the writing program at Vermont College and is a professional speaker on the issues of child abuse, family dynamics, and addictions. Thanks for being with us today, Sue. I appreciate it. We'll get your take on Governor Spitzer's situation, and you're not a therapist, but you are a recovering sex addict, so it'll be interesting to get your take on his situation. And we'll also go into women sex addicts, because we hear that men think about sex a lot every day, so we typically might associate this with more men being sex addicts, but indeed there are women sex addicts as well.
That's right, and thank you too for having me on your program. I appreciate it. Yes, absolutely. I mean, when men sex addicts are having affairs or acting out, obviously, for the most part, they're having their affairs and acting out with women who are sex addicts. I mean, people who have, you know, who have normal, healthy relationships with other people are not going to be the ones who are out there having affairs. So, yeah, so there definitely are, you know, probably just as many women sex addicts as there are men.
So would you say that prostitutes would be sex addicts in some way?
Yes, I actually would.
Let's first go with this theory that we hear that men are thinking about sex several times every day, maybe even every minute of the day. In your experience, how many do you think are actually acting out on these thoughts that they're having versus just running them through their head?
Well, I'm not sure about the actual statistics, but I think that the more important question is, what are they doing with these thoughts about sex? If they're fantasizing about sex as a way to kind of numb feelings, a way to kind of numb out any pain that they may be experiencing, and or if they're acting out on these thoughts and having sexual relationships with women men for that matter, if they're engaging in sex again to numb pain, then that would be defined as a sexual addiction. I mean, if you're using sex for healthy reasons, because of course it is part of our beings, and so if either sexual thoughts or sexual encounters are, if it's a normal, healthy, committed relationships, then I think it's absolutely fine and it's normal and it's great. But you would define, or at least I would define, someone who's a sex addict if either their fantasies or their acting out is used to numb feelings, to numb pain.
So an estimate on the Society for Advancement of Sexual Health, SASH.net, says that a conservative estimate is 3-5% of the U.S. population would meet the criteria for sexual addiction. Do you think that's low?
That's probably maybe a little bit low, and they probably would even agree with that, because a lot of people aren't going to admit to being a sex addict, you know, and a lot of people, there's so many people are in denial. But I think it's better to sort of err on the side of, you know, of caution and say, you know, that's probably, you know, a good number to work with.
So in Governor Spitzer's case, personally, I was thinking that he had shame and may have wanted to be caught. And we could also bring up President Clinton in this situation as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. Oh, I think that really is part of it. I mean, when I was acting out, I was in so much denial that I didn't know I had shame. I thought that I was just really great and sexy and wonderful, and that's why men wanted to have sex with me. And of course, that's not true at all. I mean, they wanted to have sex with me basically because I was available and I was a sex addict too. And I was filled with shame, but I did not get in touch with that shame until I got into treatment, until I really hit bottom, until I realized that there's something really wrong with my life. And then once I got in touch with what was really going on, and that I was a sex addict, and that I just had been cheating on my husbands and just, you know, not leading the kind of life I really would want to have lived, that's when I felt just enormous shame. And I dare say that President Clinton and Governor Spitzer likewise felt enormous shame when they when they were caught. Once you're really in the attic, the shame is there, but that's what denial is. You don't know that you feel shame. But then once it all kind of comes out in the wash, then definitely the shame kind of comes to the surface.
And I saw on another website today, looking through it, is that they can compartmentalize it and not feel it. So that's what you were saying. That you
exactly. I mean, denial sort of is compartmentalizing in many ways. Sure. You know, I'm sure when Governor Spitzer was involved with that prostitute, I mean, he did not think about his wife and his children. He did not think about the fact that he was risking his entire career and governorship basically for an orgasm. I mean, that's what it comes down to. And the same would be true for President Clinton. I mean, you know, here he is, the leader of the free world, risking everything for this woman who, his words, who really meant nothing to him. I mean, she was just available. You know, that's all it was. I mean, he did not have feelings for her. And it's just, she was there. Sort of risk all of that. I mean, in my own case, of course, is much smaller than that. I was, you know, risking my marriage and feelings, you know, good feelings about myself. I was certainly risking that. But boy, their stakes were high.
And on top of it, there are reports that Governor Spitzer wanted to have sex without a condom.
Which is just, oh, my, it's just,
so what
I
is
mean,
that?
It takes your breath away. It
right.
really is feelings of self-loathing. I mean, addicts basically hate themselves, and they don't feel like they're worthy. I didn't use condoms either to a large extent. Most addicts, or I can't say most, I would say a lot do not use condoms because, you know, it's part of living dangerously. There is that fear of kind of, there is that desire of living on the edge, taking risks. That's part of the high. I mean, addicts act out to feel high. Whether you're drinking alcohol, having sex, taking drugs, whatever, you want to get that sense of high. Because you don't know how to feel love, you want to feel that sense of high because you want to sort of feel something. Otherwise, you're just kind of numb. And so addicts live on the edge. And so for him, you know, to risk getting AIDS and risk his losing his family and risk the governorship, his whole career, his standing in the community, I mean, it just takes your breath away. I mean, that is the power of the addiction. I mean, that's how it really just grabs a hold of you. And that's why to get into recovery, you know, you really have to be in a group. It's that whole AA model of, you know, power of the group, getting a sponsor, having all of that additional support to keep you sober.
In your book, Lovesick, it's your story of going through treatment for sex addiction, and you wrote in Lovesick that it wasn't even the sex as much as it was the danger, as you were just describing just now.
Exactly. It's also sort of, for me, it was also kind of, and I think for most addicts, a feeling of kind of power and control. I mean, my father sexually molested me when I was a little girl.
Over and over? Until what age? Until
I went to college. And so because...
He would spend the night in your room.
Yes, or at least portions of it, absolutely. And because he basically stole my sense of well-being, my sense of power, my sense of control, then when I was an adult, for me to be able to feel any power and control, albeit it was a false sense of power and control, the only way I could feel that was like if a man wanted to have sex with me. Whether the sex actually even happened or not, frankly, it didn't even matter to me. What I really wanted was just knowing a man wanted to have sex with me, made me feel incredibly powerful. And as if I had a lot of control. And then after I would have sex with a man, frankly, I felt worse. I mean, because then, like, after basically he had an orgasm and didn't need me anymore, you know, until the next time, then I would really kind of go through withdrawal. I mean, just like an alcoholic, I would feel a real sense of diminishment, as if I had no power, no control.
As in right after the act when you were still with
him? Exactly, exactly. And then, you know, which is sort of that whole, which is why sex addiction is an addiction. I mean, it's because it is like alcohol. You know, you wake up hungover, and then, you know, after binge, you drink all night, wake up hungover. The only way you know to feel better again is what? To have another drink. Mm-hmm. And the same is true for the sex addiction. So I basically wouldn't feel better until, you know, the next time a man wanted me. And so it's just that constant spiral, that constant cycle.
This is Lisa.fm. I'm speaking with Sue Williams Silverman, the author of Lovesick, One Woman's Journey Through Sexual Addiction, and we're speculating on the Governor Spitzer situation, who's reportedly being treated for a sex addiction after being caught in a sex scandal involving a prostitute. So let's talk about your story a little bit, Sue. In your book, Lovesick, you worked on Capitol Hill, and you're a very educated woman, and you come from a wealthy family. So if there are any kind of stereotypes as far as who's sexually molested, you would break the stereotypes. Your father was an official for the Truman administration.
That's correct. And after that, he was a bank president. Absolutely. I mean, incest, child abuse takes place in all religions, all socioeconomic groups, all races. There's just, there's not just like one group where it's going to be more prevalent. The statistics that I've heard, it's pretty much across the board. It doesn't matter what your background is. You're still, at risk.
And you worked as an intern on Capitol Hill and had an affair with a senator.
I did. That's
How did that come about?
Well, he was a sex addict, too. I mean, it's just, it's really interesting how back then, I mean, when I was acting out and as a sex addict, not that I knew I had a sex addiction at all, but I could be in a party, I could be in a room full of people, and I could immediately know what man in that room I could seduce. And I dare say that the men likewise could be, a male sex addict could likewise be in a situation like that and could look around the room and say, that woman or over there, I know that I could seduce her. I mean, addicts just kind of find each other.
Now, and you said that you wore the short skirts and the lacy blouses, but it's more of a vibe, probably?
It is more of a vibe, because it's not like I would show up to work on Capitol Hill dressed in totally obscene clothes. But yes, it is more of a vibe, absolutely. I mean, it's kind of bizarre, but it's really true. I mean, like even now, I'm in recovering from sex addiction, but I can go to a party and I can pretty much tell who the male sex addicts are. But now when I see them, it's like, oh, God, that would be so boring. I'm so over that, kind of been there, done that kind of feeling.
Good for you.
I know.
Way to go.
I know. But, you really can just, but it's just amazing how, sex addicts can kind of spot one another. And again, even if you don't know you're a sex addict, it's just a matter of kind of knowing that that person would be available, kind of whatever story you want to sort of tell yourself.
When you eventually spent 28 days in rehab for sex addiction, what did you take away from that experience?
I mean, that was really the experience that kind of saved my life. And that the memoir, Lovesick, that basically takes place over those 28 days. That's basically what I'm writing about. And those 28 days were just crucial because basically I had been acting out with a man and I needed to be in a safe place where I could just be away from all of these men. I mean, I just had to be. So first of all, I was just in a safe place. But secondly...
And what led to it? What led to you actually going in for treatment?
Well, initially it came about because I finally just really hit bottom. I mean, I was just, it was sort of been one man after another. I was also anorexic. I was addicted to starvation. So I really just, at some point, I just collapsed basically. And that's what got me into seeing this therapist who specialized in sex addiction. But because I still was acting out, he basically said that, look, you have to be in treatment. You have to be in some kind of a group because basically he would say that I'm not powerful enough to to help you overcome your addiction. To his credit, that's the whole AA model, that there's power in the group and there's not just one therapist or one person who can help you. You really do need a group. So it was really at his insistence then that I go into this rehab, this safe place for this extended block of time, this period of time, where I would be with other women who were just like me. And so that was one of the most important parts of recovery, was being with these other women, because you really do need the power of the group. I'm not strong enough to stop the addiction on my own. My therapist wasn't strong enough. You just need so many people kind of surrounding you and helping you. And the other piece of that is like, okay, so you start forming friendships and relationships with these women in rehab. So like I could look, say, at my friend Helen or something. I could look at her and think, oh gosh, you know, she's really a nice person, and she, I know she really loves her husband and her kids, and here she is acting out with this man who I know doesn't care about her at all and is just using her. So like by looking at Helen and being able to see, oh, this is really bad for her, then of course you have to make the connection that, well, if it's bad for her, it's bad for me. And so it's kind of like, you know, looking at these other women, forming bonds with these other women, and as we each help each other, then it's just that much easier for all of us, you know, to stay sober. So you do have that kind of power of the group that's really, you know, helping you. And then, you know, even after I got out of rehab, say there's one night when I'm thinking, oh gosh, I really need to go act out. But then I have these phone numbers of all of these women who are in recovery, and I start calling them and telling them, oh, I think I feel like I'm going to go act out. And they would talk to me and point out how much I'd be hurting myself. And, you know, by the time after you make 4, 5, 6 phone calls to other women, you're too exhausted to even go act out.
So, the fun's gone. Like, the fun's gone, yeah, at that point.
Yeah, so that, okay, I'm just going to go to sleep instead of, you know, go act out, or I'm going to go read a book or something. So
that
was just really important to make those connections with the other women.
So are there 12-step programs for,
yes,
sex addiction?
Exactly. It's Sex Addicts Anonymous.
So people could look that up on the internet. And,
absolutely. There are websites for that. Exactly. And then they could find out where either, I think there might be even online meetings, but of course a physical in-person meeting is even better. But I think online you can find out where the closest meeting to you is, or even call some therapists in your area and ask them if they know where there's a Sex Addicts Anonymous meeting. You know, most therapists would probably have that information.
So for someone who might not be clear whether they have a sex addiction or not, how would you describe the two?
I would say that there are a few sort of warning signs or things you would look for. One is, are you using sex kind of outside of a loving, committed relationship? You know, think about whether you're really using sex, like just when you feel bad and you want to kind of numb out your feelings, kind of looking for a high as opposed to love. And then if you're, are you keeping secrets? Are you leading a double life? Are you married and are you cheating on your spouse? It's really, that's what I was doing. I mean, when I was single, I was having affairs with married men. And then when I was married, I was having affairs with married men or single men. But I mean, but I was leading a double life. I was keeping secrets. So those are the two things that I would really look for, is try to establish the reasons why you're acting out, why you're having sex. And, you know, ask yourself, well, are you leading a double life? And then how do you really feel about yourself after? I mean, do you feel kind of badly after? And if you do, is the only way you know to feel better to go out and have sex again? I mean, that's a sign that you're using sex as a drug.
Mm, wow.
I think that it's important for people to know that there is both help and hope out there. I mean, that if you're in this really dark place, you don't have to stay in it. There really are ways out. Find a therapist. Find a 12-step group. Go online. Look for resources. There's help out there. And I know it takes a lot of courage to ask for help, but it's like the best thing I ever did for myself. I mean, I really got my life back after I got into recovery. I mean, it just, I can actually kind of live now and be the real me who I was meant to be, as opposed to living as an addict.
That's wonderful. I'm happy to hear that. And how long has it been for you?
About 10 years. I've been in recovery a long time. And there is a different way to be. I mean, you'll find spirituality. I mean, you will find, you know, kind of your inner child. I mean, you'll be able to be a more vulnerable person, somebody who has feelings as opposed to just wanting to be high.
Because it's tough for people if they were hurt early on or they don't want to risk their heart. It's easier to be in situations where you're not as emotionally dependent, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I you know, was an addict for years, and to me, that was the only, I didn't, of course, know I was an addict, and I thought, well, this is what life is. And I was terrified of being emotional. I mean, I've been married twice, and each husband was emotionally unavailable to me. And that's exactly why I married them. You know, my therapist used to say that water seeks its own level. And that's really true. I mean, they married me because I wasn't emotionally available, and I married them because they weren't emotionally available. It's like we both sort of wanted to kind of be married and sort of, you know, it's like we both wanted like what normal people would want, but we didn't know how to get it. And so that's sort of what you do. But, you know, there really is a way to just find a very authentic, emotionally authentic relationship.
Do you have any advice for the wives of the men who are out living a sexual addiction?
Either if your husband is not willing to get into treatment, leave them, because there's no way that they'll ever be able to give you what you want. Just not at all. You can't change them. You can't fix them. If they will get into treatment, then I think you also need to be in treatment, because there's the whole, you know, codependency angle. You know, a codependent is addicted to the addict, basically, and their enablers. And so you'd want to get into treatment also to learn how to, you know, not invest all of your energy into the addict, into your, you know, husband who's an addict. But if they're not willing to change, and you want something better for yourself, and you want to find somebody who can really love you, then leave them, because you won't be able to fix them. You know, we can never fix anybody else.
Good,
you know, they have to want to fix themselves.
Good point. Sue Williams-Silverman, thank you so much for joining us today. Sue's book is out in paperback now. It's Lovesick, One Woman's Journey Through Sexual Addiction. And look for the Lifetime movie in April. Was there a date? Was it April 19th?
Yes, it's April 19th. And you can also visit my website, which is SueWilliamsSilverman.com. That's SueWilliamSilverman. SilverMan. That's all one word. SueWilliamsSilverman.com. And both, you can find information about me, how to contact me, information about the movie, which is scheduled for April 19th.
And you got to go out on the set for several days. There's some great photos.
I did. Yes, they're, if you go to my website, you can see pictures of the set. They filmed it out in Vancouver in Canada. And I flew out there for a few days, and it was really a lot of fun. And in fact, I have a walk-on role. I have two words that I say in the movie.
Awesome. We'll be looking for you, and we're linking from lisa.fm as well, so you guys can be sure to find Sue's website, and we'll look for the movie. And the book is it's a fascinating read about her 28 days in recovery for sex addiction. Well, thank you so much again, and we look forward to talking with you again at some point, Sue.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Sure thing. This is lisa.fm.
Thank you.